I have once again forgotten to pick up batteries, so for those of you who have watches, if you keep them somewhere, you can talk to me at appropriate times during our time together. If you'll find Exodus, find chapter 2, it's finally time to look at verse 11. We took most of last week trying to and never got there, and now it's time. Now, quick recap. Chapter 1 took us from the transition from Joseph having saved Egypt from famine to Joseph's family having been put into slavery a few hundred years later. And chapter 2 opens with the birth of Moses, who will be God's deliverer for this people. We have watched in the first 10 verses as he became adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. And then there is, between verse 10 and 11, a quiet period, presumably something on the order of 40 years. And verse 11 opens the next thing. Verse 11 to verse 15 is a day or two. So 40 years of age, and something begins to happen. I want to begin by having you look at the first phrase. Mine has four words and a comma. And those four words are, "It happened one day." This is Exodus 2:11. I think yours will have something like that. It happened one day. There's then five words and another comma. "When Moses was grown up," comma. "That he went to see his kinsmen." Another translation says he went to see his people. And I want to try to make sure you understand how much is loaded into that last little phrase. It happened one day when Moses was grown up, presumably about 40, he went to see his people. Who were his people? The whole point of our lesson last week was that he would have been torn between two worlds. The world of the Hebrew slaves from which he had been taken, miraculous or at least bordering on miraculous. The order was out to have people like him killed, and somehow he not only survived, but he survived by being adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. That took him into the Egyptian world. You would have thought that at age 40 he would have seen himself as Egyptian. It's clear by what the Bible says a little bit later within this same chapter that other people saw him as Egyptian. But how did he see himself? He went out to see his people. There's a lot loaded in that. Okay? I'd like you to hold your place here. Find something to mark this place. And I'd like you to turn to Hebrews chapter 11. As you're turning there, let me remind you, there are a few chapters in the Bible, that take on special significance as a body. Psalm 23 rises to that. 1 Corinthians 13, talking about the nature of love. Less known would be 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, which talk about spiritual gifts. Hebrews 11 is one of those chapters. What's its subject? Faith, and it's essentially the roll call of faith, or using the phrase that's loose in our world, the hall of fame for faith, if you want to think of it that way. It talks about people who showed faith in their actions. Verse 23 begins the section that talks about Moses. And I want you to notice how it's worded. "It was by faith that Moses, when he was born, was kept hidden by his parents for 3 months, because they saw that he was a fine child. They were not afraid of the royal edict." Now that's verses 1 through 10 that we've just finished looking at. Verse 24. Right now, "It was by faith that," and now they're quoting what you just read, "when he was grown up." In my translation, that's in italics, which is the way my translation handles quotations from the Old Testament or from other parts of Scripture. "When he was grown up, Moses refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter and chose to be ill-treated in company with God's people rather than to enjoy the transitory pleasures of sin. He considered that the humiliations offered to the Anointed One, that's capitalized in my Bible and it's a reference to Jesus, were something more precious than all the treasures of Egypt, because he had his eyes fixed on the reward. Now, what the verses that follow this are the verses that are going to parallel what we're about to go into. On one day, it happened when Moses was grown up that he went out to see his kinsmen. When he went out to see his kinsmen, what did he see? Mine says, while he was watching their forced labor. Does yours have a phrase that sounds like that? He was watching their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian striking a Hebrew. And then once again in my translation, it emphasizes this point. Striking a Hebrew, comma, one of his kinsmen, one of his people. Do you see Moses identifying with one side and not the other side of this? The Egyptians were imposing the hard labor. They were imposing the misery. And he saw that and identified with the oppressed, with the downtrodden. Verse 12 suggests that Moses is a lot like us. He checks to see if there's witnesses. My translation, verse 12, looking this way and that, and seeing no one in sight. Now, that's clearly not so, right? I'm not saying that what the Bible's saying is not so. I'm saying my translation of it doesn't, can't possibly be catching it. Looking this way and that and seeing no one in sight. He did see someone in sight. Who did he see? The Egyptian and the person he was beating. What should the translation have probably said? Seeing no one else in sight. Right? What's he looking for? Witnesses. What does he do? Does he have a conversation with the Egyptian? Does he discuss this matter with the Egyptian? Does he make him an offer he can't refuse? What does he do? Kills him. And not just kills him. What does he do with the body? Buries it in the sand. He looks around, and my translation says, seeing no one in sight. Who wrote this? Moses did. I think maybe I was wrong. Maybe the translation is accurate. Maybe he wasn't thinking, you know, the guy that I leave alive is a witness. Maybe he didn't think the Lord is seeing everything. Are there witnesses around? You bet there are. But he kills the Egyptian. No conversation. No nothing. No, stop that. Or he just does it. Verse 13. How does it start? I should have a new paragraph. Mine breaks things up by paragraphs. I almost feel like there should be a new paragraph here. There's a new day. On the following day, what does he do? Mine says he came back, but I think there's translations that say it in parallel to verse 11. What does it say? He came back to see his kinsmen, to visit among his kinsmen. Does yours say something like that? The following day he went back. There's at least one translation that says went back to see his kinsmen again. There's at least one translation that says that. And whether that's actually in the record or if that's just picking up the idea, I think that's certainly in the spirit of what's here. And what does he see this time? Two Hebrew men. And the description in my translation is they were fighting. Okay, what was happening the first time? The Egyptian was doing what to the Hebrew? Beating. What does that imply? It's going one way. What does the fighting imply? It's going two ways. Have you seen the NFL games or the college games for the last 2 days, for the last week? Is there ever fighting? Is a penalty flag ever thrown? Who's penalized? The last one to throw a punch. Do they always get it right? No. Do they ever get it right?
Yes.
Hardly ever.
That's your
hardly ever.
Depends on who your team is.
Yeah. But this is very interesting, because if you read a little further, if you read a little further, there was an aggressor and there was a victim in this particular case. On the following day, he came back, and there were two Hebrews fighting. He said to the man who was in the wrong, how does yours run now?
As the one in the wrong.
Uh-huh.
He said to the offender.
To the offender, to the one in the wrong. He was able to judge the situation. Okay? I'm sorry. That was important. Can I say that again? He was able to judge the situation. Well, we're going another place. He says to the one who was in the wrong, he says to the offender, what do you mean by hitting your kinsman? Now, I think there's a translation that adds one more word that my translation doesn't have.
Mine says the one that started the fight.
The one that started the fight, yeah. But look at what Moses says.
Mine says, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrews?
Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrews? I thought there was a translation out there that had the word friend. Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrews?
Mine says,
why are you striking your companion?
Why are you striking your companion? Okay. What's different this time? What was his first move the day before?
He's talking.
His first move was to judge. His second move was to kill. Here, his first move is to judge. He said to the one who was in the wrong. He said to the one who started the fight. He said to the offender, what are you doing beating up on your companion, on your fellow citizen? And what's the reply? Who made you ruler and judge? Chapter 3 is coming. Because that's exactly what God is going to do. He's going to make Moses ruler and judge. Fascinating question. Worded in a fascinating way. Who made you ruler and judge? Mine says, and who appointed you to be prince over us and judge? And that puts a different spin on it. That puts a different spin on it. So different translations put a different spin. One translation, you can almost see chapter 3 coming. The other translation, when you hear the word prince, what does that suggest?
Royal.
You got adopted into the royal family. You think that makes you a big deal, huh? And so I can't tell if the question, I suspect the question was looking back at his having been appointed, adopted into the royal family and the envy and that some of the people would have felt from that. But in the words, there's a look forward into chapter 3. And I don't want you to miss that. You have read all of Exodus now, right? Or at least up to chapter 19, right? Yes? Yes? Excellent. Who appointed you, the man retorted, to be prince over us and judge? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? I think there's one translation that says, as you killed the Egyptian yesterday. What's Moses' reaction? My translation says he was frightened. Yours says he was afraid. Any others? He feared. Okay? How many times has he had that emotion in his life? I think never. He's been the top of the heap forever. But he's still an adopted kid. And he's still from another nationality, a nationality where everybody else is in slavery. He was frightened. Clearly that business has come to light, he thought. Poor translation. Yours is better. What does yours say? Okay, that's what I need. What does yours say?
What I did must have become known.
What I did must have become known. What I did must be known. Okay? Notice how he didn't say that. What did he not say? He didn't say, what I did is going to become known. What did he say? It has become. This has already happened. clearly that business has come to light. Catches that thing. Everybody see that? It's not, oh, they're going to all find out. It is, they've already found out. There's one translation, I think, that says, oh no, everybody knows. And it's that everybody knows that I think may be a paraphrase, but I think it does capture something pretty good. One translation says that the very next word, surely, sure enough. Mine doesn't use that phrase, but there's translations that do that. Sure enough, when Pharaoh heard of the matter, he tried to put Moses to death. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. Where did he go?
Midian.
Where's Midian? East, on the other side of the desert. My wife said to me as we drove to church this morning, she said, I'm going to come as close as I can to quoting, you know, I just can't help it. When I read this, I see Charlton Heston. I just can't help it. I can remember where I was when I saw this, she said. I can remember it was in the afternoon and not at night. I can remember I was in middle school. I know the town I was in. She was visiting and some cousins of hers were all there. All of them went to the theater together. I can't help it, she says. I see Charlton Heston. And I know some of you, if you're old enough, you can't avoid that either. Okay? And maybe that's okay for parts of this. Maybe that's okay for parts of this. They certainly are. It's a little dated now. If you go back and try to watch it, it's a little more silly than it is serious, but I don't think it hit us that way when we first saw this. Where did he go? He went to Midian. Where's Midian? It's on the other side of the mountain. Genesis 25, you don't need to go there. Verse 2. It's the tail end of a set of genealogies, and it's talking about Abraham's other children. He had additional wives besides Sarah, and he had additional children. And one of those children was a kid named Midian. And presumably, it was from that side of the family that this people group had come. Okay? Seems like somehow his children and his nephews and all that became the leaders of powerful countries in this area, or significant countries in this area. So he goes to Midian. My translation ends, he went into Midianite territory and he sat down beside a well. Where has he had to go? Across the desert. How did Cecil B. DeMille do this? He had Pharaoh carry Moses to this side of the desert and send him out. And if I recall correctly, his hands were bound to the staff that later on becomes significant in the story. Okay? The picture, I think, is a little different from that. He's running for his life and Pharaoh doesn't catch him. And off he goes across the desert. He sits down by a well. The well is significant because the next people to come visit the well were
Midianites.
Yes, but say more. Midianites. Shepherds. Excellent. Keep talking. How many?
Seven
women shepherds came up. Shepherd work usually goes to men. Here you have women. Seven women shepherds. And they're all sisters. Daughters of the priest of Midian. In my translation, at this point, it doesn't say his name. In verse 16. Oh, that name is later. In verse 16, it just says, there was a priest of Midian who had seven daughters. They, presumably that's the daughters, used to come to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock, presumably at the well beside which he was sitting. Verse 17, some shepherds came and drove them away. Take a guess the gender of these shepherds. Take a guess the attitude. Use the word misogynist in what you say next. Okay? The old boy network comes and kicks the girls out. Only this time there's a difference. what happens? My translation says, but Moses sprang to their help. He sprang to their help and watered their flock. He did not spring to their help so that they could water the flock. He drew the water. He watered the flock. Okay? Your translation going along with me on this? Right? When they returned to their father, and what name do they give here? Okay. I put a note on the board, watch out for our chairs. There seem to be a few that are missing, and it doesn't look like the room has been rearranged to take them. Maybe it has. If you happen to see our chairs someplace else, bring them back. I suspect we will need them. What's the name?
R-E-U-E-L.
Okay. When they got home to their father, Reuel, he said to them, why are you back so early? What does that imply? Scripture's not saying it, but it's implying it. Most every day when they go to get water, they get chased away, and they have to wait till everybody else gets through with their water. And that makes them late getting home. Every day. Every day. Every day. I used to deliver papers. There was a day I can remember my mother said, what are you doing home so early? Because I was home at the regular time. At what should have been the regular time, but I was never on time. I was always late. I didn't have this excuse. What are you doing home so early? What is their response? Verse 19. They do not say a Hebrew slave. They did not say a Hebrew. What do they say? That was my reference. Moses saw himself. He identified with his own people and not with the Egyptians with whom he had been raised. But others saw him as an Egyptian. An Egyptian protected us from the shepherds. And that's all they need to say, because Reuel would have known about this. Why wasn't Reuel out there protecting his children? Why wasn't he out there? Maybe he was a priest and priests don't fight. Maybe he was infirm and he couldn't travel. The implication is they didn't have brothers, or if they did have brothers, the brothers were infirm or the brothers were too young. So far, okay? An Egyptian protected us from the shepherds, they said. He even drew water for us. Oh my goodness, a man doing work that would often go to women and watered the flock. Yeah.
How would the women recognize him as an Egyptian and not a Hebrew?
I would suspect by the way he looked. And I would suspect that he had been living for 40 years in Pharaoh's palace. And he had been groomed by Pharaoh's people, and he had been dressed by Pharaoh's people, that even if he had walked across a desert, he would still have some of the bearing. There's a bearing that you have if you're in charge. There's a bearing you have if you're not in charge. He had the look of the plantation owner,
to put it bluntly. All the education,
and he probably would have spoken in Egyptian, because that would might have been... He might have spoken to the shepherds in Egyptian as he chased them away. There's a certain language that you learn to do jobs like that, and the chances were he had learned that language. What was the pastor said this morning? There's a sign we have. We don't have a sign that says, I did something stupid, please forgive me. We do have a sign when... Remember that? Okay. The father's response, I think, is the greatest thing in this part of the story. It's a simple little question. Where is he? Somebody has done you this magnificent, wonderful service. Where is he? Why did you leave the man there? Go back is implied in my translation. Go back and ask him to eat with us. And it's like the girl said, oh, that's a good idea. And off they went. I don't think Cecil B. got that one right either. Now, there is a huge gap between verse 20 and verse 21. There is a gigantic and huge gap between those two. And you can tell it by the verb, the first verb you see. My translation says, Moses agreed to stay on there with the man. And to stay on there with the man who gave him his daughter, she is named Zipporah, in marriage. She gave birth to a son whom he, presumably Moses, named Gershom because he said, King James Version, I am a stranger in a strange land. This one says I'm an alien in a foreign land, but stranger in a strange land has a better voice. I heard somebody say this week they were studying in a program. They're studying things about the Bible in a program, and their professor has forbidden them to use the King James Version. How far we have come. I like stranger in a strange land. I think that captures this well. Why did you leave the man there? Ask him to eat with us. And the next thing you know, Moses, it doesn't say in my translation, Moses decided to stay on with him. What does it say?
Agreed.
Mine says Moses agreed. Is that what your translation says?
Was content to.
Okay.
Was willing to.
Does that sound like persuasion has been used on him? Does it sound like the man has invited him and that he has responded to an invitation? That's the period of time that I'm saying. Now, the period of time might have been a day or two. The period of time might have been a week or two. The period of time might have been a month or two. Yeah. The word settled is there, but my translation said he agreed to, and then it would have, the word that says settled there, to stay on with him, the word settled would have been the second half of that. I don't know if your translation has that, but the word agreed says he and the man must have gotten into a dialogue of some sort, and at the end of that dialogue, which could have taken quite a bit of time, Moses is now married, and within a short period of time, he has a son.
How did he make up his mind which one of those seven women to marry?
I don't think he was given a choice.
No.
Mine says the man gave him his daughter Zipporah. It sounds like the man chose this one.
She was probably the oldest.
Cecil B. worked on that one a bit, if I recall correctly. Okay? I don't know. Maybe she had the most interesting name. Zipporah is an interesting name. I don't hear too many people with that name these days. Okay? How are we doing? That's verse 22, right?
Yep.
That's verse 22. Verse 23 starts with four words in my translation. During this long period. What long period? The long period between the time he met for dinner and decided to stay? Oh, no. It's a long period that followed. There is another long period that goes between verse 22 and chapter 3, verse 1. How long was that period of time?
40 years.
40 years. Moses' life is divided into 40-year segments. He was 40 years in Egypt. He's 40 years in Midian. Okay? During this long period, what happened?
King of Egypt died.
Number two? The Israelites, groaning in their slavery, cried out for help. That's two different parts. Groaning in their slavery, cried out for help. And from the depths of their slavery, their cry came up to God, and God heard their groaning, remembered his covenant, and it names the people with whom his covenant was, and my list is fascinating to me, because it's not the usual list. Mine says Abraham, Isaac, and Joseph. What does yours say? Does it now? Interesting. You might want to go back and check that someday. God saw the Israelites and, final verse of chapter 2, final words of that verse, took note. What does yours say at that point? He had compassion, had concern. God heard, God remembered, God felt, and now God's about to act. And we come to chapter 3. Now, I want to pause for just a minute because there is a small problem here that we need to deal with. Who is Moses' father-in-law?
Reuel.
Reuel, right? Chapter 3, verse 1.
It says Jethro.
Okay. Numbers chapter 10.
Go back.
Depends on the translation. Some ways of translating Numbers chapter 10, verse 29 have you coming out with Hobab. Others have Hobab coming out as Reuel's son, but it's Reuel and not the other. Okay? There's one place, if you go to King James, it doesn't come out Reuel, it comes out Reguel, R-E-G-U-E-L. Numbers 10, verse 29. Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1, verse 16. The sons of Hobab the Kenite, not the Midianite, but the Kenite, father-in-law of Moses. Hobab the Kenite, father-in-law of Moses. Judges 4:11, you hear Hobab again, and you get another word, Heber. It's not quite clear in the translations who Heber was. Who was Moses' father-in-law? Let me tell you, this is where people who are critics of the Bible say, clearly Moses had nothing to do with any of this. This is all a fairy tale. He doesn't even know the name of his own father-in-law. You need to know that that criticism is lodged. I don't know how much help I can give you. If you look at the footnotes, if you have Bibles with footnotes, they'll resolve two of these. They'll resolve the Reuel and Jethro. How do they resolve that? I actually have already heard somebody say this. Okay. Some say he had two names, like Mary Jo or Bobby Sue. Right? Others, Mike just says, maybe one was a title.
That's what the footnotes here say. Mm-hmm. One was, the name Jethro may be a title meaning his excellency. That's what this footnote
says. Somehow, after seeing the Beverly Hillbillies, thinking of Jethro as meaning his excellency just doesn't fit. But who knows? I simply tell you this is a point of some contention among people who want to criticize, and you just need to be aware of that. There does seem to be some shifting back and forth, and I don't know why that is. One possibility would be that one name would be the name that an Egyptian would use for it, and the other might be the name a Hebrew would use for it. It might be as simple as that. Paul to Saul is that way. Paul did not change his name. There was just a switch from using his name as pronounced in Aramaic or Hebrew, that is Saul, into the way the Romans pronounced it, and that was Paul. There wasn't so much a name change as much as which language are you going to use to say it. However you care to do it, there's a little bit of reconciliation that needs to be done there, and I simply point that out so that it doesn't catch you off guard if somebody says something about that later. Yes, Willie?
Dan and I were talking about that this morning on the way to church.
That's because you read Exodus, and you know about this.
There must be some truth there. Yeah. but it's in a more modern way of looking at it. My family has always called me Billy, but the rest of the world calls me Willie, and I answer them both up.
I didn't know that, Billy.
Yeah. William is my real name. So, three different names for the same person.
They call me some things, but I can't repeat them in here. Often start with you. You will find Jethro, whatever the other names might be, as a significant character. But something, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it now, but just to give you context, Jethro comes across here as vital to Moses, vital to his development, and vital to his success leading the people through the wilderness. But before that wilderness experience is over, they are fighting with the Midianites and wiping them out. So you start, I simply put in there, you may want to see Jethro as an exception to the other Midianites. If you think about what happened with Moab, what happened with Seir and other places where descendants of Abraham had settled, and you end up fighting with the children of Israel someplace or another. Midian seems to fall in more into that category. But Jethro seems to have been an exception. How long was Moses in Midian before chapter 3 starts? About 40 years. What did he do during that time? Worked as a shepherd, clearly, because by the time chapter 3 starts, that seems to be his usual duty. But shepherds aren't away all the time. And I want to propose to you one other role that Jethro may have had. He is a priest. A priest in what religion? It's not the Jewish religion, because that doesn't exactly exist yet. That doesn't exactly exist yet. You have Abraham, and you have a lineage in which the promise and the covenant is coming, and it's going to be renewed in a very powerful way when we get to Exodus 19, but that's not really all codified yet. So, who's he a priest for? The answer seems to be, he was a priest of God. Which means the education that Moses got as an adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter is now supplemented, maybe here, by an education about who God is. And I believe if you put that role in for Jethro, you will be accurate to what I sense is the spirit of what the Bible is saying across here. Jethro comes out in a very positive light, and that never changes. The Midianites sometimes come out in a negative light. But there's something about Jethro as a spiritual guide. If you keep watching along about Exodus 18, the first 10 or 12 verses, Jethro is actually leading a worship of sacrifice, celebrating the fact that these children of Israel have been able to get out of Egypt. And there follows a long section where he gives Moses advice on how to conduct his affairs. Moses is learning from him both in the civil area and in the spiritual area. And Moses apparently sees him as a leader and one whose advice and one whose counsel is worth following, as well as one whose spiritual guidance is worth following. And I want you to see that. Whatever the name, Reuel, Jethro, maybe one of these others. I think the way I read it, Hobab seems to be a son of this man who comes along later. You'll see a place where Hobab is actually the guide that the children of Israel have as they go through the wandering in the wilderness. There's one little place where you get a glimpse of this and you don't hear about it anymore. Are you about to say something? It
yeah,
looks like
well, I was looking in my dictionary, and I think it's interesting. They define Reuel as a shepherd, the friend of God.
That's
it
what
shows a close
the
point.
L. The
yeah.
L is.
And Jethro is his excellence.
And that fits with what Mike
nice.
Says. Okay. Okay. Enough of that. Enough of that. Enough of that. Enough of that. Chapter 3. At this point, it is vital that you know about Ken Miedema. Because if you don't know about Ken Miedema, what we're about to do will not come alive. So, in the next week, I invite you, go see if you can find a song sung by Ken Miedema. There's probably a YouTube video or someplace where you can just listen to this online.
Well, I tried to look it up before, and it's hard to find.
Yeah, it's very hard to find. If I had found it, I would be playing it right now. Ken Miedema is a blind songwriter. A couple of you know about Ken Miedema because you did something to me a few years ago, right, Allison? But some of you may have forgotten about it or may not have been here. You sent him a bunch of information that he wrote a song about me and sang it, and you gave it to me as a birthday present long ago. I have not forgotten that. In any event, don't know. Just be aware it's out there, because I'm going to tell you about his song as we go through. Now, what happens? You're going to inevitably see Charlton Heston and Cecil B. DeMille's work right here. What happens in chapter 3? We've got about 7 minutes. Let's hit the highlights. Let's hit the highlights. According to your watch, we should have 10. Is that right? Okay, so I'm 7 or 8 minutes. Let's hit the highlights. He is, chapter 3, verse 1, looking after the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of God, not an angel of God, the angel of God, appeared to him in a flame blazing from the middle of a bush. Who's that? That's the pre-incarnate Christ. That's the pre-incarnate Jesus. When you hear an angel, that means one thing. When you hear the angel, that means something else. This is God in a form that human beings can interact with directly. appeared to him in the flame. Moses looked. There was the bush blazing, but the bush was not being burned up. Moses said, I must go across and see this strange sight, find out why the bush is not burning up. A rough translation, this I gotta see. That's a rough translation of what you hear there. Okay? When he says go across, I have the picture. He's up on one hill, and this is happening on the next hill over, and he has to go down and go back up the next hill. I picture him up on a hillside where he can see down into valleys and so off to the side. Right? When the Lord saw him going across to look, God called to him from the middle of the bush. Moses, Moses, he said, here I am, Moses answered. Come no nearer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. I am the God of your ancestors, God said. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. At this, Moses covered his face, for he was afraid to look at God. The Lord then said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying for help on account of their taskmasters. Yes, I am well aware of their suffering. At that moment, what is Moses almost certainly thinking?
I'm glad you
took you a while. I figured this out 40 years ago. And when I tried to do something about it, it all went kaput. I've been over here 40 years. You just now figuring this out? What took you so long? I doubt he quite said it out loud, but I suspect the thought went through his mind. And, God continues, this is verse 8, I have come down to rescue them from the clutches of the Egyptians and bring them up out of that country to a country rich and broad, to a country flowing with milk and honey, to a place where people already live, but we're going to drive those people out. Yes, indeed, the Israelites' cry for help has reached me. I have seen the cruel way in which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Stop, read no further. What's Moses thinking now? He's thinking, hallelujah, about time. This has been needed for a very long time. And then God says, verse 10, and all of a sudden everything shifts. What does he say? I'm sending you to Pharaoh for you to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And Moses says to God, who am I to do such a thing? The God of your, and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you. They're going to say to me, what is his name? What am I supposed to tell them? And God said to Moses, pause. Any of you go to the worship service this morning? Any of you hear Travis talk? Notice a verse? What's God's answer? My name is I Am. I am who I am, King James says. I am he who is. For me, everything, all of time is present tense. It is very hard to even begin to wrap your head around what God just said. God further said to Moses, you are to tell the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name for all time, and thus I am to be invoked for all generations to come. Hebrew language did not have vowels. It only had consonants, YHWH. You can pronounce that Yahweh, and you can pronounce that Jehovah. Jehovah is the more familiar way that many of you will have heard. So far, okay? What's Moses' response now? Ken Medeba puts it this way. Not me, Lord. Not me, Lord. And what are his problems? His problems are, I can't speak so good. That's the way Ken Medeba puts it. What's that in your hand, God says? It's a stick. Throw it down, Moses. God, you haven't lived out here very long. There's all kinds of things out here that are trying to kill me. And the stick is the only... Throw it down, Moses. God,
we cannot help us.
Yeah, you're hearing Marcia Franz. Those of you who are old enough are hearing Marcia Franz, because she's the one who sang, but Ken Meade is the one who originated. Throw it down, Moses. But this is the only protection I have. How do I throw it down, Moses? And when he throws it down, what does it become? No, not a snake. Not a serpent. A hissing snake. What's the difference? Hissing snakes are angry. And God said, pick it up, Moses, by the tail. Oh, God, I know you haven't lived here very long. Number one, you don't pick up a hissing snake. Number two, if you do pick up a hissing snake, you sure don't pick it up by the tail. Why not? Pick it up by the tail, what happens? It's got plenty of room. Where do you pick it up? By the head. Pick it up, Moses, by the tail. And when he picks it up, what happens? It becomes a rod again. And Kim made him a shift's gears. The rod of Moses becomes the rod of God. And you're almost through with the story. Now we're going to come back because there's so much in here, it's probably going to take 3 weeks to get through this section. But I've got a real important question. We are not through. I need 2 minutes. Why did the bush burn on this day? If you've already heard me talk about it, don't talk for a minute. I want to talk to those of you who have never thought this before. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in the wilderness in Midian, and on one particular day, my translation, verse 3, chapter 1, here's one day. How many times so far? It happened one day. It happened one day. Why that day? Those of you who have not thought about it before, why? It could be this was the day that finished 40 years in the wilderness. It could be something else. What do you think? When you read far enough in here, there's a point. The thing about I can't speak so good, God actually gets angry right about there. And God says to him, who gave people a mouth in the first place? Don't you think if I need you to talk, I can teach you to talk? Don't you think I can give you the words you need to say? God got angry. And then he says something that if you realize what he's saying, you suddenly understand everything. Look, God says. I'm now looking at chapter 4, verse 13. At the middle of 13, the Lord's anger kindled against Moses, and he said to him, look, there is your brother Aaron coming to meet you. He talks pretty good. Work with him. Look, there is Aaron, your brother. The day the bush burned is the day he saw Aaron again after 40 years. He probably knew Aaron was coming. It's probably been weighing on his mind. How did Aaron get out of Egypt? He's a slave. He sneaked out at the risk of his life. And Moses knows Aaron is coming, but he's forgotten about it in the moment of the burning bush. So let me put it all together for you. This is how God calls people into his work. He gets your attention. He won't use a burning bush for you, but he'll use something. And when you turn to see what's gotten your attention, he calls you to worship, take off your shoes. This is holy ground. He reveals to you need in the world. I have heard the cry of my people. I've come to make a difference. And then, the frightening part, he calls you to meet that need. The list does not end there. The fifth point on the list is he begins to equip you. And what does he give you? He gives you his presence. I will be with you. He gives you his power. Here's the rod. And he gives you people alongside of you because you cannot do any task alone. But God's people with God's presence and God's power can do amazing things. Look, there's your brother Aaron coming to meet you. I want you to see the overview, and we're going to come back now and dig into this next week. Let's have a prayer before we go. Our Father, we thank you that you're still calling people today, and that each time you call us, it begins with you getting our attention. You then lead us to worship. You open our eyes to the way you see the world with all of its need, and then you frighten us to death when you call us to meet that need. And we cannot do it except that you equip us. You equip us with yourself, with your power, and with partners with whom to work. In this room are many partners, and I thank you for them. I pray that you would teach me to be the partner that you've made me to be for others. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.